Body. It's clearly, if you flag up something people are curious about, people will turn out. So there you are, rather than just yet another lecture on John's Gospel, something which perhaps we haven't given much thought to. The question, who is St. John the Evangelist? This is a, I wouldn't say vexed, but a contested question, but I want to make some suggestions. And I think the first thing is, I've been pondering this a little bit, not that this is official or anybody in the church is necessarily going to take this up, but I want to give John a second title, and that is the Insider, because much of what I say is going to be to do with how the very heart of things John, the writer of the Gospel, actually is, and in ways that I guess we may not have come across, not least because we're dealing with very ancient documents of the early church, and it's not the sort of thing necessarily that we take for bedtime reading. As I said earlier, or said last week, the book which has helped stimulated a lot of my thought for going back to John's Gospel was only just published this last year by John Baer, a very distinguished Orthodox Christian scholar and theologian. And it's called John the Paschal Gospel. And his suggestions and the things that he points to, I think, drive us deep, deep, deep into the very heart of our faith. You'll remember last week I said that the heart of the matter is the matter of the heart. We need to get to the very heart of things, the very centre of things. So we pondered the temple last week in our first talk, because partly because, of course, that was the Feast of Candlemas, which is the feast of Jesus' presentation in the temple. But secondly also that once you've seen the theme of the temple in John's Gospel, you suddenly realize it's everywhere. And when I teach Christian faith from scratch, or indeed teach the Bible from scratch with people, I use some words of Jesus in the temple from John's Gospel. Because I think when you do that, as I said to somebody just this week who I met and I explained a little bit about it, I said, when you do this, all scripture suddenly leaps into three dimensions. And we understand that we're caught up in a much bigger picture than we ever imagined. It's like it encompasses everything from Genesis to Revelation, if we just get one or two things clear about Jesus and the temple. It's a unifying theme that draws all of Scripture together and then begins to speak in and through all of it. So John the Insider. Now, I suppose if I was going to ask you who was John the Evangelist, I wondered just very briefly what anybody might like to guess or say. It's all right, it's perfectly fine. All right? So has anybody like to pitch in or anything? What do we know? What do you think?
The longest lived of all the disciples.
The longest lived of all the disciples, okay? So John is certainly very long lived. And of course,
the one Jesus loved.
Right, so this phrase, the beloved disciple, or the disciple Jesus loved, is another one that comes to mind, and this is internal evidence from the Gospel itself. Herein is an interesting question, isn't it? So there we are, there in a sense we go straight in a sense to the nub of the matter. Is John the brother of James and a son of Zebedee, or is he not? Now, the main church historian who ascribes the identity of John, the writer of the Gospel, to John, the son of Zebedee, is a man by the name of Eusebius of Caesarea. I'm digging around quickly in my memory, I think it's correct, and he's a very important early church historian. Except, of course, he wasn't that early. He's 3rd to 4th century. So the church is getting into its more settled phase. And everything is relaxed a little bit now. We can go over the papers and make our decisions from 300 years' distance, which is always a bit of a problem. Yes, as I said last week, one of the problems that we have is we assume we know so much better, despite the fact we're so much further away. And so we must be a little careful with this. And you can almost see in Eusebius, as you see him, it's clear from his writings he's got certain prejudices and he wants to push things in a certain direction. So we notice it, but we also say, right, having noticed that, are there things then we need to just be a little bit wary of with regard to Eusebius? Because he is, if you like, the first big church historian. I have a copy of his writings. It makes interesting reading. But as I say, he is quite a way down the track after Jesus and the disciples and John. So I want to come a little bit closer. And I want to come closer to some more significant witnesses. Now, of course, one of the questions we might ask is John, who writes the Gospel, also the writer of, for example, the letters? I don't think anybody disputes that the writer of the Gospel is also the writer of the first letter. Okay? But of course, there are three letters of John in the Scriptures. And the other two, John 2 and John 3, are called from John the Elder. Now, of course, being very long-lived, one becomes, as it were, an elder. Indeed. He wasn't, in a sense, the only elder. Elders was a title given to those, quite often, who had either known the apostles, yes, there are people who are older in faith, the people who are closer to the heart of things. But just step back for a wee while, just very briefly, and I'll come back to this, because one thing's just crossed through my mind I should maybe have said. How many disciples did Jesus have?
A couple of hundred-ish.
We don't know. Thank you. We don't know. It's funny how we always leap to 12, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Now let me ask you another question. If you didn't have Matthew, Mark and Luke, how many disciples would you think Jesus had? And the answer is you'd be very much in the fog. John never mentions 12. He never mentions the 12. It's really interesting. He never mentions the 12 at all. In fact, he has very little to say about the disciples of all of the Gospels, but is the one that has got very, very little to say about the disciples. There's an opening passage where Jesus doesn't call the Gospel. People actually go chasing after Jesus. John the Baptist says, "Oh, behold, the Lamb of God." And Andrew and another of John the Baptist's disciples go after him, you see. But there's very few named disciples in John's Gospel. There isn't a list of 12. Jesus doesn't just go up a mountain to pray about who can be the 12 apostles. Okay. Right, so let's just hold that, and that's an important thing to hold in place. Okay, so we're not clear. We know, for example, in Luke, Jesus sends out 72. Yeah? 72. On the day of Pentecost, there are about 120 gathered. Okay, these things we know. How many we know from John's Gospel? At some point, of course, Jesus, having taught about being the bread of life, turns round to his disciples, and some of them say this is too hard, and they leave him. We don't know who these people are. Yeah? They're not recorded who they are. So I just want to say that perhaps the disciple crowd is a little bit less clear than if you'd only ever read Matthew, Mark and Luke. You'd be going, oh, 12, of course it's 12, and the answer is 12. Of course it's 72 as well, because Luke says that. But if we just have those three Gospels, then we might say that. And it's interesting how that shapes our answer to a certain extent, who is John who writes this Gospel? Because the one John that we know from the other lists is, of course, John, the son of Zebedee. Except John, the writer of the Gospel, only makes one passing reference, and never by name. And that is right at the end, I think, where they go fishing. And how many disciples go fishing? Does anybody remember? You remember?
Four.
No, not four, no. Seven. Simon Peter, Andrew, Thomas, interestingly, for a number of reasons that we'll come back to months down the line, no doubt, and the sons of Zebedee, plus two other disciples. It's interesting. John never quite fills in the lists. He always leaves spaces. He leaves spaces. Right, let's come back to the elders then. And here are some very, very important elders, two of whom you might have heard of and one of whom you won't have heard of in all likelihood. There is a man called Polycarp, who was the bishop of Smyrna. If you know the Apocalypse, the Revelation of St. John, that is one of the churches that John writes to. Yep, Smyrna. Polycarp was a disciple of John, the writer of the Gospel. Okay, we know that he knows this John. Irenaeus is the most important witness in some regards because we've got a lot of Irenaeus's writings. And he writes a great deal about John, the writer of the Gospel, and he writes about him in very warm terms. Why? Because Irenaeus deeply loved his mentor, his teacher, the man who had passed on the message of Christ to him, Polycarp, and Polycarp was devoted to John. It's a beautiful story of how that real life that is in the Gospel is passed, as it were, from the heart to the heart. So imagine, here is John, the beloved disciple, who reclines at the breast of Jesus, close to the heart of Jesus. And then he disciples Polycarp. And Polycarp disciples Irenaeus. And there is a great sense of devotion in Irenaeus's writing to the person of John, who has written this Gospel. We also have another person called Papias. Now, Papias was a friend, a companion of Polycarp. We know this from Irenaeus. And he was a hearer of John, a hearer of John who has written the Gospel. And here are some words of Papias. We haven't got very much left. There's a few fragments. Yes, Eusebius had a stack of stuff, and I think it's a bit naughty with some of it, but anyway, never mind. And Papias says this. He was talking about how did he come to his decisions. One of the things that Papias was really interested in was whether or not Matthew and Mark in particular had got the order of things right. And he said, no, they haven't. You see, because he was really interested in what John had said. But which John? So he said this. This Papias said, and this is reported by Irenaeus, he said, I inquired about the words of the elders. That is, what, according to the elders, Andrew or Peter had said, or Philip or Thomas, or James, or John, or Matthew, or any other of the disciples of the Lord. Okay, so what they had said. Yeah, so he asked those. Now, that's really interesting, because actually that list of disciples is pretty much in the order they turn up in John's Gospel. How interesting. He's been formed, in a sense, by, that's one of the bits of evidence that Papias not only knows John who wrote it, but he actually knew the Gospel itself. So he says, I inquired what these elders, is what, according to the elders, Andrew or Peter said. So he's asking people who've met the apostles. So what was it they said? What did they talk about? Yeah. So he's a second generation witness, you might say. And whatever Aristion and John the Elder, disciples of the Lord, are saying. It's very interesting. So he has kind of two types of witnesses. He's talking to people who've talked to the apostles, but he's also talking to these other two people, Aristion and John the Elder. Yeah? John the Elder, disciples of the Lord, what are they saying? And then there's this lovely, lovely phrase he used. I did not suppose that things from books would profit me as things from a living and abiding voice. What a beautiful phrase. I didn't want to look it up in dusty parchments. Yeah? How important that is. How important that is. That personal connection. I always say to people, Christian faith is deeply personal. It is transmitted personally, from person to person, from heart to heart. For the heart of the one who believes will flow streams of living water, which will then, as it were, bring fertility and life to the hearts of those that hear and believe themselves. And I just want to, at this point, just again slightly digress with some words of Origen, who is a little later again, as an interesting character. He fell out of favour, but recent church history says he's actually been very badly done by. And he said this, Origen wrote a tremendous amount, by the way. He said this, "We might dare say then that the Gospels are the first fruits of all scriptures, but the first fruits of the Gospels is that according to John, whose meaning no one can understand who has not themselves leant on Jesus' breast. How is it we can receive the truth of the Gospel? Unless, is it where we have heard the heart of Jesus." It's a beautiful phrase. Now I'm going to come back to this. This is a really interesting passage, and I'm going to come back to this several times over the year, because I've cut it off and there's a lot more there that I would want to share a little later on during the year, but not for now. We must hold that, as it were, in place. So what we have is we have this generation of elders, people who have known the apostles, and Papias, he sets aside especially two elders who are still living, whom he has obviously spoken to, one of whom he calls John the Elder. Now, I think the idea is here that this is somebody who knows Jesus. Now we come to Irenaeus again. Irenaeus, as I said, writes with great devotion and mentions John, the author of the Gospel, on more than 50 occasions, writing very specifically about John, who wrote the Gospel. He refers to him on nearly a third of those occasions as the disciple of the Lord. Now here's the really interesting thing. Irenaeus knows of many disciples. I'm sure Irenaeus knew of disciples whose names are now, as it were, forgotten to history, but not forgotten to God. But he never, ever, ever refers to any other disciple as the disciple of the Lord. It's quite interesting. He places a very, very, very special emphasis on John, who wrote the Gospel. He does write on a very few occasions about John the Apostle. That's John, the son of Zebedee. But as his interpreters have said, there is none of the warmth of the affection with which he writes about John, the writer of the Gospel. It seems quite clear that these are not the same two people. The tradition has always said that John grew to a great age, as Werner's reminded us, and by the way, remember the figure in the east window with the long beard is not Jesus. We have a Sunday by Sunday reminder, yes? That's John the Evangelist, and if you know your halos, you can tell it's not him, okay? Because the halo of Jesus always has a simple cross figure in it. Those who are very close to Jesus get a slightly different one. If you go and have a look at another time, and you might always see the same also in the halo above Joseph as well, in the window with Joseph and Jesus here. Okay? Okay? There's a lot to be said. There's the figurative nature of stained glass, there's a lot to be said about it. But okay, so the east window, okay, why does it look like such an old man if it's Jesus with the little children? Answer, it's not Jesus with the little children. I'm so terribly sorry. Many generations of children being taken up there at Christmas time and told it's not Father Christmas, it's Jesus, but it's not. That's John the Elder, who lived to a great age, tradition tells us, in Ephesus. And he was the beloved. It was said of John that in his last years he was carried into church aloft, saying, little children, love one another, love one another. So I now quote a modern scholar who says this: there is nothing to suggest that John the Apostle, the son of Zebedee, is the same person as John of Ephesus, the beloved disciple and the author of the gospel. There is no sense of character given to the son of Zebedee, nor the personal affection that Irenaeus shows when writing about the teacher of his beloved teacher, Polycarp. John the Apostle is never called the disciple of the Lord. And so we must understand that the writer of the gospel is understood as John, the disciple of the Lord, the beloved disciple. Yeah? The beloved disciple. He is this living voice. This is, I think, the power, I think, of John's gospel. It's not only an eyewitness, it's a heart witness. And this living water is passed on down through the generations. He is, as it were, one who substitutes personal knowledge for mere facts. He's the only one, of course, of the gospel writers who we are clear, obviously did know Jesus personally. The tradition says Mark probably learnt it from Peter, secondhand. But it's only John's gospel where the author, as it were, claims to know Jesus himself. Okay, so that's about the elders. We might actually have a look at the gospel itself. We're not going to unpack it tonight. We'll have plenty of time to unpack the text at another time. But what do we deduce from this? Well, firstly, this thing about anonymity. I mean, he never says, I, John. He does in the Apocalypse, interestingly. And by the way, I'll just throw this into the mill at this particular point. My reading is that the Apocalypse is a lot earlier than the Gospel. I've thought that for some considerable time, and I'm afraid nothing I've read has dissuaded me of the fact. So, in fact, if you want to get closer to the heart of authentic Christian writing, you might find the Apocalypse of John is a wee bit closer. So it's just a thought, but anyway, come back to that, no doubt, later on.
Written earlier.
So what might we deduce from the gospel itself? Firstly, of course, there is this theme of anonymity. As I said, he never says, I, John, at any point in the gospel. But there are these, as it were, spaces that he can occupy and that perhaps we might occupy as well. So, for example, as I've said, you know, when the disciples of John the Baptist go off after Jesus, it says, Andrew and another disciple. How interesting that he's not named. Of course, as we know from John 13:23, the disciple whom Jesus loved. Again, I think this speaks to us of how John the Evangelist wants to draw us into this profound relationship with Jesus, whom he loves. He wants to leave space for us. If there was a named disciple at the breast of Jesus, where would the space be for us? And actually, I think that this would be entirely in keeping with the way the ancient literature would work. We are schooled very much in a way of reading and a way of hearing that is somewhat alien to those who wrote the scriptures. And I think these little techniques, these little ways in which the anonymity and the rest of it is an invitation to draw us in, to also lie at the heart of Jesus, for if Origen is correct, unless we have lain at his breast, we cannot begin to understand what's in the gospel. There are the two others fishing, of course. And then there is that allusion to his longevity. As Jesus says to Peter, and Peter says, but what about him? Pointing to the disciple whom Jesus loved, Jesus said, what is it to you if he remain until I return? You see? As obviously the tradition did grow up, that John would not fall asleep, which actually is a far better Christian way of putting it. Okay, Christians don't speak about dying. Okay, this isn't an avoidance of death. We also don't talk about passing. Okay, falling asleep is the classical way in which Jesus, which is a great thing to think, actually, because falling asleep in the presence of Jesus is a wonderful thing to do. So when you struggle with your prayers, just be thankful that you're falling asleep with Jesus. So there's little hints in the gospel itself, but I want to actually come to now to the insider. So we have this one sense of that insider, which is, I think, the most important one. But I want just now to step a little bit further, because there are things that are in the text that John writes that alert us to the position John held. John is known to the high priest. This gets missed. And how a Galilean fisherman would come to be known to the high priest is, well, you're going to have to do a lot of work to get that figured out. But if you remember, when Peter is stood outside, nosing in at the gate, yes, when Jesus has been taken inside, John has gone in with Jesus. And then he arranges for Peter to be brought through, because he was known to the high priest. That tends to get a little bit skated over. It's an interesting comment. And that's in chapter 18, verses 15 and 16. He gets Peter in. He knows the name of the servant of the high priest, Malchus, quite possibly personally known to him. He mentions Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus. Who are they? They're members of the Sanhedrin, the ruling council. One of the things that we find in John's gospel, if we're paying attention, is that there is, as it were, division amongst the leadership about Jesus. They are slightly falling out over him. They're beginning to accuse and saying, what, are you going after him as well? There is, if you like, a fracture in the community of those in the leadership of the temple and the Jewish people. He knows what's going on in the meetings. Which is rather odd, isn't it? Yeah? We, of course, tend to skate that by and say, oh, it's all made up. Well, let's assume that perhaps we're wrong. Yeah? He knows what is said. He is an insider. He's very close to the action. And there is a really interesting, very interesting note in a letter of Polycrates of Ephesus. Now, one of the things that seems about the relatively early church, which actually maybe comes to fruition in the 11th century with the great schism between the East and the West, is there is a tension between Rome and the churches in Asia Minor. The churches that are addressed in the Apocalypse, of which, of course, the church in Ephesus is one. And I don't know whether you're aware of this, but part of the tension was over the date of Easter. Because as I said last time, John does not treat it the same as the other three gospel writers. Jesus is crucified in John's gospel on the day of preparation. Now here's the thing. Matthew, Mark, and Luke have them all sitting down to eat the Passover meal. But you can't have the Passover meal until the day after the day of preparation, because there's no lambs that have been slain. And so there is a dispute between, as it were, Rome, which is beginning, as it were, to feel its power a little bit more. The church in Rome, as things settle down there, and the churches in the east. And so Polycrates writes to the then Bishop of Rome, Victor, about the date of Easter. And he mentions a whole list of Ephesian worthies, good Christian people, who hold to this other tradition. You see, about when do we celebrate Easter? And he mentions amongst them this one. And this gives you the meaning for that strange note at the bottom there. Speaks also of John, who lay on the Lord's breast, who was, or perhaps who became, a priest wearing the petalon. Now, you might think, well, what on earth is that? Okay. The petalon was the headdress of the high priest. Now, the question really is this. In what sense is John, the writer of the gospel, the high priest? It's possible, and some people have tried to make an argument, that he was one of the high priests, but it doesn't quite seem to fit the record. But here's another thought. Where would the high priest be present except at the sacrifice of the lamb? John's account of the crucifixion is completely different to the description in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, because only in John's gospel are the disciples at the foot of the cross. One male disciple, the disciple whom Jesus loved. Is it perhaps the possibility that the early church understood that John was, as it were, functioning as the high priest, as it were, at the crucifixion of Jesus? A remarkable insider, and I think an absolutely fascinating thought. We will actually come back to this, because what happens at the cross is, of course, fundamental to our faith. And Jesus' words from the cross to the disciple whom he loved and to Mary are also, I think, fundamental to our identity as Christians. And so I do want to return to this again. But I think, save enough to say for now, that actually whoever we think he is, John's witness comes right from the very heart of Jesus. And I believe from the very heart of everything that is happening. And it's quite possible, in fact, I would say very, very, very likely, that our entire observance of Easter, in many regards, owes itself to John himself. Which is another remarkable thought, but we will come back to that as well. And so there we are. John, the evangelist. John, the elder of Ephesus. John, who wore the petalon, in some sense, the high priest. John, an insider into the Jewish hierarchy. And perhaps that's why his gospel, of all the gospels, was the one that, as it were, as most, as it were, separates out about the Jews, because for him it was the most personal thing, having been right at the heart of it all. Amen.